The aftermath of Charlie Kirk's killing comes to Palmetto Bay. A reborn budget comes to Miami-Dade. And a controversial Stand Your Ground ruling comes to Broward. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we're going to touch a hot stove. The free speech debate raging after the Charlie Kirk shooting, specifically in Palmetto Bay, whose mayor, Karen Cunningham, will talk with us about ousting Councilman Steve Cody. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava will tell us how a county budget that looked wrecked got repaired and approved. And we'll discuss why a Broward County judge just let a police officer off in a deadly shooting case. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. In the week since the horrible shooting death of controversial conservative activist Charlie Kirk at a peaceful political debate at a college in Utah, this country has been wrestling not only with the reality of our political violence, but with our responses to that political violence. It's a problem of both the right and the left, of course, but in recent days it's been liberal responses to Kirk's killing and the conservative backlash to those liberal responses that have turned this into a national debate over free speech, and a local one. This week, the village council in Palmetto Bay in Miami-Dade County voted overwhelmingly to call for Councilman Steve Cody to resign over an admittedly insensitive social media post about Kirk's death. Cody is refusing to step down, but the dispute is a vivid micro snapshot of the macro struggle that's playing out between the civic urgency to temper offensive speech, but the just as important constitutional urgency to protect even offensive speech. Joining me now in the studio to discuss this is Palmetto Bay Mayor Karen Cunningham, who introduced the measure to remove Steve Cody amid a storm of public protest against the councilman. Mayor Cunningham, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's my first time at WLRN, so I'm super excited to be here. Unfortunately, not for this particular issue.
Welcome, but this is an important issue.
We
very much appreciate you coming
to
talk about it. I want to just first remind people what Councilman Cody rather sarcastically posted on Facebook after Kirk was killed. He wrote, quote, "Charlie Kirk is a fitting sacrifice to our lords, Smith and Wesson. Hallowed be their names," end quote. Cody was referring there to Kirk's staunch support of gun ownership. Smith & Wesson is, of course, a major U.S. gun manufacturer. Cody later deleted the post and apologized for it, as he says here.
"Well, I put out a post and was not the most well-thought-out thing I've ever done. If I had thought about it longer, I probably would have just kept that thought to myself. Only after it was out did I realize that the pain that it would cause, not just to Charlie Kirk's family and friends, but to a much wider community."
Not the most well-thought-out thing. That's an understatement. But Mayor Cunningham, why did you and the Palmetto Bay Council members feel this was grounds for calling on Cody to resign his council seat? What Palmetto Bay Code of Conduct, for example, was the measure that you introduced against him based on?
There is no code of conduct in that sense where we could remove the council member from office. But as you pointed out, this is a very important issue. The comment itself was not well received by me or by many of the residents that live in the village of Palmetto Bay. And I think when you have something on a public platform, regardless of whether it was removed later and an apology issued, there has to be discussion about that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, there was a lot of Palmetto Bay resident anger vented this week at Councilman Cody and at you and the council itself, demanding his ouster. What do you say to skeptics who suggest, though, that your call for his resignation has more to do with appeasing a community where most people voted for President Trump in 2024 and who support a lot of the pro-Trump conservative causes Charlie Kirk championed?
Sure. Well, they also voted Council Member Steve Cody, so a Democrat.
Who is a Democrat, right?
Yeah, okay. And so we're nonpartisan, and a little bit about my background, which I think you're aware of, Tim, mm-hmm. is I was a first grade teacher, mm-hmm. now retired. When I was in the classroom, I held myself to a higher standard. I'm teaching and taking care of children from all kinds of backgrounds, all parents of all different political affiliations. I think the comments, besides being insensitive, just really don't represent the values of a community. Mm-hmm. And again, I go back to the fact that I don't make decisions on my own. I have to bring in the council. And the only way to do that is through discussion. Based on the number of individuals that reached out in a very short period of time, I decided that it was necessary to at least have the conversation. Policy is the way we do that.
Going back early this year when the state representative in Minnesota was murdered for political motivations as well, she was a Democrat, had there been a conservative on the Palmetto Bay Council who had made the same sort of comments about that Cody made about Charlie Kirk's killing, would we have seen the Palmetto Bay Council call for that council member's resignation as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought you were going to ask if something had occurred like that in terms of was there any kind of comments made on social media as derogatory and upsetting as this
one. No, I was just asking hypothetically. Yeah. And again, I certainly don't want to defend Steve Cody's offensive remarks, but there is the First Amendment question of defending his right to make those remarks. And along those lines, what do you say to critics who suggest Palmetto Bay is violating Councilman Cody's First Amendment free speech rights in that regard?
Sure. Well, listen, we're all entitled to free speech, right? But as I said, you know, we serve in a very public role. We have families, children watching our behavior. I think as elected officials, we're held to a higher standard. Again, it's my opinion. There's a process. I'm very big on process, whether it's from a zoning hearing, mm-hmm. You know, to something as unfortunate as this. So there's a process in place for me, for our village council. Our first step to have conversation, difficult conversation, mm-hmm. About this situation with the comment that Councilmember Cody made was to bring policy so that we could have a discussion about it.
Now, I should note we invited Councilman Cody himself to join us today. He declined. But as I mentioned, as Americans right now, we should also be concerned about reducing all the incendiary political rhetoric out there, obviously. And I know that you're a registered independent, as I am. But is it fair for us to say that there has been a lot, if not too much, of this kind of insensitive and hateful speech from liberals in the wake of Charlie Kirk's killing? And there is perhaps a need to remind Democrats at this moment to curtail the way this is tarnishing their side of the aisle as much as perhaps the Republican side in the past.
Yeah. Well, you're probably not going to like my answer because for me, this is specifically about the posting that was made by Councilmember Cody. I live in the village of Palmetto Bay, as I know you do. I know that as well.
I was going to disclose that a little later.
Yeah,
in the talk.
It makes mm-hmm. for even a cooler conversation as a constituent. You know, this to me is the community that we live in. Quite frankly, it's an amazing, beautiful community, kind, caring, compassionate people, 25,000 residents. I represent every single one of them. They may not like the policy decisions that I make, but I also feel in the past 11 years, having walked a number of doors and having lived in the community for 30 years, that this kind of comment from a council member does not represent the values of our community. And that's a nonpartisan For okay. me, that's nonpartisan.
Along those lines, though, I think we can draw a parallel between Councilman Cody's toxic response to Charlie Kirk's killing and the toxic response by Republican U.S. Senator Mike Lee to this summer's politically motivated murder of Democratic Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, which I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. when Lee said, quote, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way." Again, both remarks, Cody's and Lee's, very offensive. But there was no resolution in the U.S. Senate urging Lee to resign, as you and the Palmetto Bay Council are calling for Cody to step down. What's the difference?
Well, I don't know. I guess maybe at the federal level, their party affiliations, even though we're in the village of Palmetto Bay. We all, I assume, have one of three party affiliations. We're either Democrats, Republicans, or no party
or
affiliation. In my case, my position is no party affiliation. I want to be representing everybody. And all of the action that I've taken thus far, the council has taken thus far, is focused specifically on a comment that somebody representing the village of Palmetto Bay made. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why at the federal level they don't take action, but I know I've got our process in place, and so we're following a process.
In the wake of liberal late-night TV host Jimmy Kimmel being taken off ABC this week after his own insensitive and inaccurate remarks regarding the Kirk murder, the Trump administration is being accused of hypocrisy because while the right has long championed the protection of free speech, it looks now like it's only interested in protecting free speech that it agrees with and that it now wants to censor free speech it doesn't like. Attorney General and former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi had to be reminded this week that even hate speech cannot be prosecuted in the U.S. Do you worry that Palmetto Bay's actions against Steve Cody might be playing into that, those accusations of hypocrisy?
Well, again, you know, we have a process to follow in the village of Palmetto Bay, right? We, in order to have discussion, we have to bring policy. I brought policy forward to at least have the discussion since so many, not only in Palmetto Bay, but beyond Palmetto Bay, because, you know, I know that the residents of Palmetto Bay are watching, but I was getting calls from people all over the country, all over the state. It wasn't just...
It resonated.
It resonated. And of course, some of this stuff hadn't already happened. The Jimmy Kimmel situation hadn't already happened. I do see, as you're saying, that this is expanding. Obviously, there's issues happening all across the nation. But my focus was on the process. How do I address this egregious behavior within the village of Palmetto Bay?
Steve Cody says, in spite of the Palmetto Bay Village Council vote against him this week, that he is not going to resign. What other recourse, if any, does Palmetto Bay have to remove him from the council?
Sure. So we passed a resolution on a 4-1 vote. It made a couple of requests. One, we asked the council member to resign. We censured him. And then we also, this resolution was sent on to the governor's office a few days back. From there, the people can, part of our ordinance, part of our process, they can begin a recall process if they'd like. That would have to kick off in December. I know there's some signatures being taken now, but they won't be valid because a council member has to serve 1/4 of their term in order for the recall process.
Okay.
Then they would have to have 10% of the registered voters. That's recourse number two. And then recourse number three would be for the governor to take action. And there's grounds for a removal from office. They, in the state of Florida, it's malfeasance, misfeasance, neglect of duty, drunkenness, incompetence, permanent inability to perform official duties, and conviction of a felony involving moral turpitude.
Okay. No, thank you very much for that explanation. We'll be watching, obviously. Karen Cunningham is mayor of Palmetto Bay. Mayor Cunningham, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me today.
Still to come, Miami-Dade County's mayor tells us how the budget got saved. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. Over the summer, it looked as though Miami-Dade County was headed for a painful financial reckoning. After cutting property taxes and losing COVID-era federal funds, but raising spending for salaries and services, Miami-Dade was staring at a $400 million budget deficit, or so we thought. Last Friday, Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava presented a $13 billion budget that did not have to raise transit fares, slash funding for arts, or ground rescue choppers. Last night, the Miami-Dade Commission approved it. So did Mayor Levine-Cava salvage this budget, or was it Harry Houdini? How did Miami-Dade escape that deep a hole? The mayor said she found a lot of, quote, short-term fixes, as well as surprise surpluses at so-called constitutional agencies like the county tax collector's office, as well as some new pricing on services like MetroConnect. Even so, the other question is, how and why did Miami-Dade confront the initial budget scare in the first place, and will it still be there next year? Joining me now is Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. Mayor, thank you as always for talking with us.
Absolutely, Tim. It's a pleasure to be with you and for that great summary.
So first, Mayor Levine-Cava, take us back a few months ago. Why was the Miami-Dade budget looking awash in so much red ink, in your opinion?
Right. So let's start with it's a new day in county government in Miami-Dade. So there was a passage of a new constitutional amendment that required the election of constitutional officers, three of them brand new, the sheriff, the tax collector, and the third one, election supervisor.
Right.
These were all functions that reported to me as the mayor. And now we have independently elected offices that are not accountable directly to our county commission. And then the two that existed before, the clerk and the property appraiser, all of their budgets come from the same pot of money. So when you pay your property taxes, now you're paying for six government agencies instead of basically one, because the two before really coordinated more so with the county. So that costs more money. Yeah. And also the way they do their budgets, they don't have to submit them until May. And then they're not allowed to carry funds forward that they can't spend in the current fiscal year. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to tell us that till really towards the end of the fiscal year. So we have to put out a budget in July that doesn't know what funds will be coming back from the constitutionals. And the most significant is the tax collector, because tax collector actually gets the money up front.
Yeah.
That is 2% off the top of the taxes due. And by the way, the county pays for the school board's portion and essentially for the city's portions as well.
Yeah.
So even though we don't get those into our budget, we pay the 2% commission.
Right.
So go ahead.
No, and I want to get to that tax collector office factor in just a second. But either way, let's fast forward to last Friday, and suddenly, after weeks of hand-wringing over issues like arts funding and especially money for community-based organizations or CBOs and their charities, you and your staff emerged from the numbers-crunching cave with a budget that has patched up all those holes, which is great, but how? Walk us through the solutions you found to these fiscal conundrums.
Right. I know you said something about Houdini or like Phoenix rising from the ashes. I wish it were like that. But no, essentially, I outlined for you the difficulty. We cannot plan for revenues that we don't have. There's really no such thing as a deficit in the county budget. We have to have a balanced budget.
Right.
We can only spend what we have. So really, it was a shortfall. And it was a shortfall until we could get from the constitutionals, and even the tax collector doesn't even have to tell us until later in the next fiscal year. Fortunately, that they were very helpful and cooperative, especially the tax collector, and he was able to anticipate, which we expected. He couldn't spend all of that 2% because remember, we were collecting taxes for much less, but he has new obligations. He has to staff and maintain the Department of Motor Vehicles. That was an unfunded mandate from the state, and everybody up in arms how poor that service was.
But is it true that the very large budget the tax collector got in this scenario allows him to hire, for example, about 500 new employees?
Yes.
Does that mean that while some jobs might be cut from your administration, other government sectors are growing? I mean, I'm just looking at the effect that this tax collector's office factor had here of that $400 million budget deficit we're talking about a quarter of that involved this new constitutional office, right?
Exactly. No, as that office alone. But overall, about half of the shortfall was due to the constitutional offices.
Right.
And yes, the largest portion of the tax collector. But again, it's the nature of how it's handled that the tax collector takes the money, takes it off the top, and then doesn't have to even tell us in the current fiscal year how much money he won't need to spend.
Right.
And technically, he could spend it all in the next year. So he has to project to be able to tell us with certainty that he won't need certain funds. So he's not allowed to have a surplus either, but we don't have to, we don't have a right to know about that until later. So it's really a conundrum.
The other big anxiety, obviously, in the run-up to this was there, you know, the charity factor and the community-based organizations that, that the county funds to carry out those charities. There have been calls to come up with a different way to fund the huge number of nonprofits that offer charity services like food banks and legal services to low-income families, so that these proposed funding cuts don't happen again in the future. Do you have ideas on how that might be accomplished?
Yeah, I want to put this in context. First of all, I'm a social worker as well as a public interest lawyer. I've started myself numerous nonprofits, and including a few that are receiving county funds. I don't know how many county governments in the state of Florida fund as this county government does the number of nonprofits. It's not a mandated service. Yeah. Obviously, it's good. It's good for the community. We need to partner with these organizations that provide critical work in our community. So that to be said, when we were staring down a $400 million shortfall, and we only had certain places we could take it from. We can't take it from the airport, the seaport, water and sewer, fire, libraries. These all have dedicated revenues that can only be used for their purposes. We can't take it their excesses and move them someplace. So we were restricted in what we could do. And we needed to maintain basic services like maintaining our roads and our parks and our transit system and our police, our sheriff. All of that is in that general revenue. We went in to every department that we could and cut between 10 and 20% of those budgets. We streamlined and so on. So when all was said and done, we had to, we had to propose to cut what was not an essential county function.
Well, let me look at one of those arenas. In last night's county commission deliberations, for example, Commissioner Anthony Rodriguez seemed to play a key role, especially when he pushed through the transfer of money for future transit projects to preempt transit fare hikes this year. I'm sure Metro Rail passengers greatly appreciate that, but does that also smack a little of creative accounting, if not kicking the can down the road? Is it sound budgeting?
Yeah. Look, we have to deal with the reality. This is not a sustainable solution. We do have monies that are collected from the increased property values along transit corridors, and we tapped it for this one-time fix. We're going to be facing the same challenge next year.
Yeah.
We can't keep borrowing from a pot that is there to pay for major transit enhancements.
Right. And I want to get to that, but right now let's talk about last night's good news for a moment. The commission-approved budget keeps property taxes flat while only modestly raising fees for services like water and trash pickup. And as I mentioned, all the arts and charity funding that looked threatened remains intact. What, to your mind, are the parts of this rescued $13 billion budget that are most gratifying?
Okay. Well, I care about our community so much, and I was just personally devastated to have to cut back on our community partner organizations and the arts. So I am very excited about that. I'm very happy that our transit riders won't have to pay despite the fact that it's been over 10 years without an increase. And we have the largest percentage of free and subsidized transit of any major transit system, as far as I know. And yet, of course, we have traffic. We need people to ride transit. We've improved transit. So, you know, I'm happy about all of those things. However, I know that they are not sustainable. And I do feel like I'm the one telling the truth. You know, I'm the one saying, like, guys, you know, okay, but you are kicking the can down the road.
Right. There were people on the commission last night who were voicing concern that while it's good to see the budget perils resolved for this year, the county is still staring at a lot of unresolved problems for next year, such as funds that you could use to fill holes this year that probably won't be available next year. Commissioner Oliver Gilbert even remarked that this is, quote, like using a Band-Aid after an amputation.
Yes.
What does need to be done between now and next year to address those concerns?
Well, as far as our community partner organizations, we've already started bringing together philanthropy experts. We're going to be developing strategic plans. We are going to do all of that together with those affected. And I think they heard us. You know, we told them last year. We told them the year before. A lot of them were getting one-time funding from the federal government, American Rescue Plan dollars. But yet, they're providing essential services, so it was hard for them to hear that. So we're planning already. And as far as the proposals, two things so far. Our Vice Chairman McGee has proposed legislation. It has to move forward. That would essentially put an additional set aside from county contracts procurement that would go into a pot to help fund these organizations. You know, that has to pass. And it will be new revenue, but it has to come from somewhere. Right. Then there's the tax collector who is creating a way for donating, essentially, while you pay your taxes. So helping create an easy way for folks to contribute to the nonprofit sector through their tax program. And there's actually a third. We have a philanthropist that stepped up.
Yeah.
And through the Miami Foundation is creating a new source of
revenue. We have to leave it there, unfortunately, Mayor, for time. Daniela Levine-Cava is mayor of Miami-Dade County. Mayor, many thanks as always, and congratulations on the resolved budget. Still to come, a Broward judge dismisses the deadly case against a Miami-Dade cop. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. We're familiar in Florida with Stand Your Ground, the self-defense law that allows you to use deadly force if you feel you're facing a threat of death or grave injury. In fact, our state pioneered the law 20 years ago. But we usually associate it with folks involved in incidents like road rage. We've rarely, if ever, heard it applied to police conduct. Until yesterday, when Broward County Judge Ernest Cholera dismissed the case against Jose Mateo, one of four Miami-Dade County officers charged in the deaths of a UPS truck driver and another innocent bystander during a chaotic 2019 shootout in Miramar. Judge Cholera cited Florida's Stand Your Ground law and said the hailstorm of police gunfire was justified because it was directed at two armed criminals who'd hijacked the UPS truck. But Cholera's ruling has nonetheless stunned a lot of folks in South Florida, where excessive police force is a longstanding and chronic problem. Joining me now in the studio is the journalist who yesterday broke this story, WLRN's government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos. Josh, how are you?
I'm good, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Let's first walk our listeners through what happened on December 5th, 2019, which started with a robbery in Coral Gables in Miami-Dade County and ended with that shootout in Miramar in Broward County.
That's right. So two robbers that day held up a jewelry store in Coral Gables. They exchanged some gunfire with the jewelry store owner, and then they left with the goods, and they took a U-Haul truck and started running away from police. The police were alerted by a silent alarm. They started running away from the police in the U-Haul truck, but they ditched it in a suburban neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that's when they came upon a UPS truck that was being driven by 27-year-old Frank Ordonez.
Ordonez, right.
So they held him at gunpoint, they took the truck, and they held him hostage. And they led police, multiple police agencies, on a high-speed chase up to Miramar, which is in Broward, which is many miles away.
Yeah.
And it all culminated when the UPS truck was stuck in rush hour traffic in a very busy intersection, so they couldn't move. And that's when police swarmed in and started exchanging gunfire. And it was, like you said, a hail of gunfire. There are some reports of upwards of 200 bullets.
Right, exactly. One of the big considerations here, though, is that this shootout took place at a very busy intersection, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, Miramar Parkway and Flamingo Road, which suggests police officers would have wanted to exercise special caution while engaging these criminals who had UPS driver Frank Ordonez at gunpoint there. Is the contention of Broward prosecutors in this case that they disregarded that need for special caution when they started firing as furiously as they did and ended up allegedly killing or causing the killing, not just of Ordonez, but an innocent bystander motorist, 70-year-old Rick Cutshaw.
That's correct. So, yeah, that is definitely the contention of those who have kind of put some scrutiny on these officers, is that they didn't exercise as much caution as they should have. I mean, in the past, you know, Florida has had laws about high-speed chases, that, you know, police should not engage in high-speed chases unless there's special circumstances because it poses a danger to the public. And I remember when this happened, Tim, in 2019, there was a lot of commentary about the fact that the police were using civilian cars as cover. I just watched the video again, and the police get out of their vehicles and they're coming up on the UPS truck with their guns drawn, and they're kind of ducking behind regular motorists' cars, which some would say is putting the motorists and civilians in danger.
Yeah.
So prosecutors definitely brought that up and said that this was not a justified use of force to, in the middle of all these civilians, start firing, like, you know, some would say the OK Corral.
I want to play a remark here from Ordonez's brother, Roy Ordonez, that seems to sum up how a lot of people feel about what happened that day.
Mm-hmm. The police ended up murdering my brother while trying to escape. And, you know, they did a horrible job. And there wasn't any, you know, direction or anything like that. It just, like the witness said, they immediately on scene, they opened fire.
So, Josh, would you say that's essentially been the argument Broward prosecutors have been making as well?
Yeah, basically, that there needed to be a higher level of care and caution, and that the training, that their conduct was sort of putting people in danger. And we should clarify and put a finer point on the fact that an FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigation, found that the bullets inside Ordonez, when they did an autopsy on Ordonez, right, the bullets belonged to those Miami-Dade police officers. It was not the gunmen, the robbers that shot him.
So, Josh, what are then the charges that these four Miami-Dade police officers, Jose Mateo, Richard Santiesteban, Leslie Lee, and Rodolfo Mirabal, what are they facing in terms of charges from this tragic incident?
Felony manslaughter, right? Okay. So that would be, you know, he was killed. It's a form of homicide, but it's unintentional. They did not intend to kill him, but he died as a result of them.
And since 2019, they've all been suspended without pay, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, however, Broward Circuit Court Judge Ernest Cholera has dismissed the case against one of those Miami-Dade officers, Jose Mateo, using what seems like unprecedented grounds in a police use of force case like this. That is Florida's stand your ground law. Mm-hmm. What does Mateo's attorney feel that his actions that day deserve, or why they deserve stand your ground immunity? And why did the judge buy that argument?
Right. So you normally think about stand your ground law in terms of like protecting yourself from a home invasion. You know, they call it a castle doctrine.
Yeah.
If someone's breaking into your house and you feel threatened, you can shoot them.
But your ground, you took this beyond the castle out to, like, if you're in a parking lot having an argument with somebody and you feel threatened with them.
Right. And so that's what Mateo's attorneys argued, is that that Mateo felt threatened. And so he protected himself and others around him by using deadly force. And shooting and firing his gun. Now, the interesting thing about this that critics are looking at is the fact that, you know, that might count towards a defense for normally shooting and killing the person that is threatening you. But Ordonez and Cutshaw were not threatening the officers. Mm-hmm. And yet the officers shot, you know, accidentally Ordonez and Cutshaw. So the fact that they used stand your ground law and the judge agreed and said this was, you know, agreed with this argument, is really unprecedented and has a lot of implications for police conduct in the future.
But why would the judge reason that a scenario involving police engaging armed criminals is equal to an individual, as we said before, feeling threatened in a dispute in a parking lot?
The judge basically said that the evidence presented showed that this was an extremely aggressive and dangerous scenario that the police were in. You know, there was multiple gunmen. There was a lot of things going on. There was this high-speed chase. There was a hostage there. And so because of the danger presented to everyone around them, including themselves, it made sense that their violence was justified. And they said that the state did not argue well enough that the violence was not justified.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what the judge ruled.
Will the three other Miami-Dade police officers charged in this case likely argue that they, too, deserve stand your ground immunity?
It's very likely. So those cases are ongoing. I think Mateo's is the one that was moving forward the quickest. There hasn't been a hearing yet in the and the other three cases. But I mean, considering that this argument held up, it's very possible that those other officers will argue the same thing. Although it's worth noting that the details are likely slightly different. There might be different, you know.
Yeah, sure.
But so there might be differences. So we have to see that borne out. But it's definitely interesting.
Are the Broward County prosecutors appealing Judge Collera's ruling?
That remains to be seen at this moment, but I find that likely.
Okay. Finally, Josh, as I mentioned at the outset, this ruling is perhaps resonating with a special jolt, because especially in Miami-Dade and Broward counties, the South Florida community in recent years has had to deal with a lot of police abuse force incidents. If this kind of stand-your-ground immunity can be applied to police conduct cases, what new concerns does that raise?
I mean, like you said, Miami-Dade and South Florida are no strangers to police-involved deaths and police-involved shootings and a lot of things like that. So the fact that this is a new defense, even beyond the normal immunity that they have because of their law enforcement, I think it's kind of scary for critics, and especially now in Florida, where civilian investigative panels and independent investigative agencies that look into police are now outlawed.
Yep. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. Josh, thanks as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you,
Tim. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.